Escondido.
Great Plow Hawk, my name is April.
Hi, April.
Hi, y'all. I was talking to Bill a little bit during the break. Happy birthday, Bill. 31 years, that's a big deal. A little too low? I could hear me. Did Jackson knock it out of the park or what? He did such a great job. Yeah, absolutely. I want to thank you guys for having me. And where'd Nancy go? Nancy, welcome to AA. Was looking for you during the break. So, and you guys too, but I usually try and talk to the women. So grateful to be here, grateful to be sober. My sobriety date is September 24th, 1989. My sponsor is Michaeline F., and my home group is the Sunday Morning Paper up in Escondido. So always like to mention those things. And I'd also like to thank my friends for coming down and hanging out with me and stuff. My friend Danny wanted to make sure that I mentioned his name and told you guys what a good guy he is and stuff. So I figure that covered it, right? I'm good? Okay. All right. Yeah, happy to be here. Super happy to be here. And I couldn't agree with you more, Bill. This is the best thing that's ever happened to me, too. AA fits me. And there'd always been something wrong with me. And AA fits perfectly. If I wasn't an alcoholic, I'd have just been so weird, you guys. I would have just been this weird, weird person with no solution and no idea what the problem was. And that was what it was like growing up. It's like I never really knew what the problem was. But it's like, really, if I want to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, well, I was really weird, and then I was drunk and really weird, and then I couldn't be drunk anymore, so then I was sober and really weird. And fortunately, we have a program for people like me. Because when I sobered up, it didn't really take care of what was wrong with me. Now what was really wrong with me was right in my face all the time. I didn't have that alcohol to kind of hide that anymore. When I first got sober with a whole crew of people, and some of them had these really intense stories, you know, about their life and their childhood and all that stuff. And I don't have that. And I used to actually kind of try and embellish some of the things about my childhood so that I could keep up with these people that just had gnarly, incredible stories. And the truth of the matter is I come from a nice family, and I grew up in a nice town. And I have good parents. I have brothers and sisters that can prove they were good parents. And it would have been a really, really nice, normal, happy family, except for I was in it. I was what was wrong with the Thayer family. Just off from day one. And I didn't really mean to be off. I just was. And, you know, things that made sense to me didn't seem to really make sense to other people. Certainly didn't make sense to my parents. But, I mean, I wasn't a little deviant or anything, but it looked like I was. Because, see, I have this thing, I have this alcoholic mind, and, you know, even though I come from a really nice family, alcoholism doesn't care. It doesn't care where you grew up. It doesn't care who your parents are. So I would just, you know, other kids that I was going to school with and stuff, and brothers and sisters and stuff, I mean, they were the kind of people that when they would read a warning label on something, they actually thought of it as a warning. Right? And me, no, it piqued my interest. Now, if it said, keep away from fire or flame, I have to know what happens if you light it, right? And so, or if it says, do not puncture or incinerate, I've got my brother's BB gun, and I'm over hiding behind the picnic table. Let's find out why they don't want you to puncture it. And really, I mean, and that looks like a really bad kid, but it really, to me, I just thought I was curious, and I had other stuff to think about, and I didn't really want to listen to the teacher because I was thinking about things. And that didn't go over very well with the grown-ups. So off I'm going, and I'm just kind of being this really weird, intense kid. And, you know, like I said, my parents were good people, and they were kind people, and they were smart. They were smart enough to make sure that us kids got an education and that we got an introduction to, they sent us to Sunday school, which was a beautiful thing to do, and I have nothing bad to say about that experience. I had a wonderful, wonderful time, except for I had alcoholism. And I could look around, and I would look at all the other kids in the Sunday school seats and their bright, shiny faces and stuff like that, and I would look at them, and I would think, how do you know how to do this? you know? And Jesus loves me. Well, he loves you, but I don't think he loves me. I mean, how could I? You know, I mean, I just have burnt down the house practically. And by the time I was 8 years old, I was just terrified of God. And because I have alcoholism, because I have this weird alcoholic filter, sometimes when things are said, it comes in through this alcoholic thing, and it kind of gets jumbled up and translated weird, and it means something different to me than it means to other people. And I was hearing bad, scary stuff. And I don't think they were saying bad, scary stuff. But like I said, by the time I was 8 years old, God was the boogeyman. And that's a terrible place to be. You know, and so I was going to tough that out for another couple years. And then when I was 13, December 29th, 1973, I got drunk for the first time. And I'd had drinks before. I mean, my family's Irish, and so you get to drink when you're Irish. But I'd never had enough drinks. There's a certain amount of drinks if you're an alcoholic. You can have a sip off of a beer, or you can have a half a glass of wine, or you can have, and it doesn't do it. I discovered on that day that a third of a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill fixed something that had been wrong with me all my life. Always been wrong with me. And it just, oh my gosh. I mean, I woke up that morning the same way I wake up every morning. I mean, I was just tense and just freaked out and just, you know, so obsessed with what you think of me and just all of that stuff. And I got a couple of good pulls off that bottle of wine, and it was like, oh. There I am. I mean, it's like when you undo the top button of your jeans, you know, and you get to go, yeah, all right. It was just great. It was a great feeling. And I was going to cruise right on past that perfect feeling. On that day, at that time, by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I was the best I'd ever been in my life. I had discovered what had been wrong with me all my life. I'd been sober. And if I could just be drunk, if I could just have this much booze in me, everything was going to be okay. But I have alcoholism. And if you know anything about alcoholism, you know that I have a phenomenon of craving that's going to occur. When I put alcohol in my body, I can't stop at 2 drinks. If I could stop at 2 drinks, I'd be the nicest person you ever met in your life. But I can't stop at 2 drinks. I have an allergy to alcohol, and what that means is that if I take a couple of drinks, I'm taking the rest of them. And for the next several years, my story was going to be about, you know, just overshooting the mark and overshooting the mark and overshooting the mark. I never meant to do it. There was a whole bunch of stuff in my story, and I never meant to do it. I never meant to turn out like that. That wasn't the plan. But I have alcoholism. And for me, that little moment of perfection, somewhere in the middle of that drunk, it's worth everything I have to break, destroy, all the people that I have to hurt. It's worth it to get that little bit of peace. Do you feel me on that? Yeah. So I also have a lot of dry goods in my story. I liked other chemicals besides alcohol, but I'm going to stick to alcohol. But I will tell you that I figured if booze did this for me, I can't wait to find out what everything else does. And I did. I found out what everything else does. And nothing did it for me quite like booze did, though. I mean, I've gotten sideways on a couple of different things, but booze was, I mean, it's the thing that unlocked it. It's the thing that... It's like all the tumblers clicked into place, and it was like just perfect. So like I said, I'm off and running, and you know, one of the other things that I like to mention that alcohol was able to do is that God that I found real scary, he'd become my enemy by the time I was 13 or 14 years old. And what a couple of drinks of alcohol did for me with that God is it just, I could drink God small. You know, he got real unimportant, and I wasn't scared of him anymore, and I got that drunk bravado thing. And that was a really comfortable place for me to be, too. I got into a lot of trouble. I mean, I was already in a good deal of trouble just as a kid, and now you add alcohol and other chemicals to the picture, and it got really, really ugly. And that nice family that I came from, I was going to break their hearts and terrorize them and shame that family. And I didn't care. I didn't care. You know, I didn't even know I came from a good family until I got sober, took the steps, and looked back at my family, and I went, whoa, they were really great. And they've stayed really great. you know, the whole time that I've been sober. But, you know, I'm out ripping and running, and I don't care what that feels like for them. And it's not that I thought about what it felt like for them, and then I dismissed it like I don't care. I never thought about what it was like to be them. I never thought about what it might be like to have a kid like me, you know, and until I got sober and I started taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God there's 12 of them, because if all there had been was me finding out about me, oh, I just thank God for the rest of the steps, right? So what ended up happening to me, I got arrested a lot, and I was just kind of out, you know, tearing up the world and all that stuff. I got exiled to Nebraska for a minute. I'm actually from Escondido. I'm still living in the town I was born in, but I did get sent to Nebraska for a couple of years, and I'm living in this small town with that family, that good family, and my dad's from there. I mean, we had relatives all over the county and stuff, and it was a bad deal for them because of me. The people down at the, you know, the feed store or whatever it was, they'd go, I heard about what happened to your daughter the other night. You know, it was in the paper that she got arrested again. And I mean, it was just, and they're in this small town and having to live with this. And, you know, so I got out of there as soon as I could. And I came back to California, and I'm off and running again. I got arrested again right after I turned 18. I used to get arrested a lot, but when you're a minor and you get arrested, nothing happens, you know? Your big sister comes and gets you out of jail. It's really not that big of a deal. She's the one who has to get up, you know? Who cares? But I got picked up a little assault charge after I turned 18, and things got real different then. I actually had fines to pay. They wanted me to stay in jail for a minute. Now there's a probation officer involved. I mean, I thought, oh, where's my sister, you know? Why can't she just come pick me up? So I thought, I probably ought to start doing something different than what I'm doing. And my solution was find a guy, right? I'm sure I'm not the only girl who's ever had that solution before. Can I get an amen on that one? Yeah. So find a guy that's kind of got his stuff together. He was a thug. He was a criminal. He was an outlaw, but he was kind of trying to get out of all that. So I just hitched my wagon to his and just latched onto him and spent the next 10 years making his life miserable, basically. It was his misfortune that he actually really loved me and he would put up with anything that I would do. And if I broke it, he fixed it. And if I made a mess, he cleaned it up. And I didn't care. I didn't care. I would go out and I would disappear for, you know, sometimes I would go out and I would say, I'm going to be home tonight, and I'd come home tonight. And other times, I wouldn't be home for 3 or 4 days, and I'd said I was going to be home tonight. Or I was just going to go down to San Diego to pick something up, and I'm going to be back at 5, and I'm even going to make you dinner and all that stuff. But, you know, I had a couple of margaritas with my enchiladas, and off we go. And I might be home tonight, and I might be gone for days. You never knew. So I would just do these disappearing acts with him. And when I would come home, I mean, he always had the same stupid question, why can't you just call? Because you're a drag, basically. And I could make it his fault, kind of. And this really weird thing happened, and I didn't know that this happened. I learned so much about me in retrospect, but I didn't remember this until I was taking a thorough first step. And I came home in the morning, you know, the creeping, crawling into the house in the wee hours in the morning, and you know, so we start this argument, and he asked me, you know, why don't you call? And I said, I don't know, Tom, it's weird. It's just like I get a couple of beers in me and I just don't give a rip about you anymore. I told the truth. I never told the truth again. Don't worry, it's okay. But, you know, that one time it slipped out and I, you know, quickly just swept it away, and I don't think I ever thought about it again until I got sober, and it's like that was the truth. I get a couple of beers in me and I don't care about anybody. I care about more beers. I care about more drinks. I care about where's the rest of it. I care about the party. He and I were into, all kinds of illegal behaviors. I mean, I'm in my 20s, I was cute, I was funny, I was lazy, I had no capability of holding a straight job, so I did everything that a cute, funny girl does to make money in the 1970s and the 1980s. And one of the things that we did was we figured out to start growing weed. So we were growing weed, and the reason why we were doing that is because I hate pot. I don't like it. I don't like being stoned on pot. I'd rather have the flu than be stoned on pot. So I figured if we grew weed, we would actually be able to make some profit, because if I'd have been working as a cocktail waitress or tending bar, I wouldn't have made a dime. If I'd have tried selling coke, I wouldn't have made a dime, right? But weed, good. And we made a lot of money, and we did really, really well with that. And we bought stuff, and we were living large, and we were having a good time, and everything was going perfect. Until this one night, we'd gotten a burglar alarm because we had a whole lot of stuff in the house, and we were just kind of afraid to leave the house because the scummy people will come by and rob our house. So we got this burglar alarm. Now, we don't have it hooked up to the sheriff's station or anything like that. We don't want the police coming. We just want a loud noise so that the burglar goes away. And anyways, one night we went out, and I didn't close the door properly, and there's a five-minute delay on it. And about 5 minutes after we drove away, our alarm went off, and our good neighbors down the road called the sheriff because somebody's burglarizing our house. And sheriff shows up, and the door is ajar, right? So they come on in, and they're looking around for the burglar, and they didn't find a burglar because there wasn't one, but they did open up a closet and find 37 pounds of pot in there. So, and in, you know, it's not a big deal now. But in 1987, it was kind of a big deal. It was kind of a big deal. We were in a lot of trouble, right? So we come home from the movies, and we come pulling up the driveway, and we park the car, and all of a sudden, all these cops jump out from the bushes, and they've got their, get out of the car, put your hands on the hood. And we had just been to see Beverly Hills Cop, so we were like, oh, funny, right? And they meant it, so they, you know, get us out. So, next thing I know, me and my partner are handcuffed, sitting on the kitchen floor back to back while the DEA is tossing our house, and we're in a lot of trouble. He's not getting out of it. He's got a record. He's got a jacket a mile long. He's doing some time. That's all there is to it. But I don't have any drug charges. None. Okay? So I'm going to get away with this. So what I was able to do was I was able to actually convince the judge that the 37 pounds was for personal use, right? Because a sales charge is prison time. And possession or cultivation, that's a little county jail time. Slap on the wrist, I'm good. And that's what I want. And it actually worked. I was able to convince them that it was all for personal use by just sounding very dumb and very squeaky and too stupid to be a criminal, and the judge bought it. So what they did with me is they gave me a 2-year suspended prison sentence, probation, and drug diversion. And drug diversion to get me off pot, okay, because I have this really bad problem with pot. So part of that drug diversion was that I needed to do 16 AA meetings. Actually, 16 self-help meetings. It was my choice what I wanted to go to. And what I did was I did what I do. I waited until I had about a week before I had to meet with my PO for the first time, and I hadn't done any of the meetings, right? And I'm going to meet my PO next week, so I better get my butt to a meeting. So the first meeting I ever went to, I'm looking through the schedule, and somebody, you know, the counselor at the diversion place gave me, and I found out that, oh my gosh, there's an 11 o'clock meeting at the Vista Entertainment Center, and I drank at the Vista Entertainment Center. I went, perfect, right? I know exactly where that is. So I come walking into this meeting late. It was a Sunday morning, 11 o'clock is kind of pushing it, right? And just to kind of give you a little visual here, I was also into... I was into some stuff that would keep me up for several days in a row, right? And I was kind of into the punk scene at the same time. And if you've been up for days and days and days and days, you start seeing stuff out of your peripheral, right? And because it's all the way out here, you turn and it's not there. I mean, you would just turn. And it was never there. There was nothing there. So I thought, it's my hair. So I shaved the sides of my head. And I could... Yeah, and I kind of had spiky mohawk-y hair and black lipstick and pierced this and tattooed that. And I come walking into the Vista Entertainment Center at 11 o'clock in the morning, well, probably more 11:15, knowing me. And I walk into this room in my punk regalia, right, ripped up leather jacket and, you know, all that stuff. And the whole room is filled with cowboys, cowgirls, and jarheads. Just flat tops and beehives as far as the eye can see. And what there's this other thing happening is everybody's singing in the room, and there's two people standing up in the front of the room, kind of a Dolly Parton-looking gal and a Merle Haggard-looking guy, and Dolly's holding a cake, and the cake's got a big old five on it, right? And Merle is a senior citizen, I promise you. Right? And everybody's singing happy birthday to Merle, and I'm thinking, he's five? He's at least 55, right? This doesn't make any sense. What a freak show. And I did see one girl sitting over kind of by the coffee area, and she had kind of this magenta hair and this really just crazy cool makeup job. I mean, like five different colors of eyeshadow and this really cool funky outfit. And her hair was like shaved on one side and long on the other. And I mean, she just looked cool, right? My kind of person. Only to me, the only normal person in the room. So I go sit down next to her. And they probably started the meeting or something. So I want to know why Merle thinks he's five. Right? So I'm going to introduce myself to this girl, and I said, hey, my name's April. And she turns to me, and she kind of puts out this lily white hand, and she says, hi, my name's Michael. I'm an alcoholic. So she wasn't a she. She was a he, which is weird in 1987, right? It's not that weird now, but it was weird in 1987, I got to tell you. And I was just like, no kidding, right? Michael was awesome. Michael was great. Michael was 17, and he'd been sober for a year and a half, and he was just fun. He was just so full of life, and anytime I go talk any place, I always like to say, I don't know whatever happened to Michael. He and I lost touch, but he probably saved my life, so thank you, Michael. Because what he did is he snatched me up, and we got those 16 AA meetings done with time to spare. And he was on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous, and he just dragged me all over the county doing meetings. We just had a great time. Somewhere in that time frame, I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm not going to be sober for a long time, but I was in love with this thing right away. I mean, you kind of got to love someplace where, you know, people say the F word and God in the same sentence. I'm like, yeah, right? And or things like, I'm sitting there in a meeting one time, and I got this little blue-haired lady sitting right behind me in the Ali Alano Club in Escondido. And I mean, when I say blue hair, I mean the kind that has, like, the little wobbly head like that, like she can't hold it still. And she spits on her thumb, and she rubs my shoulder. She's sitting behind me. She goes, oh, my God, is that tattoo really say cocaine lady? And I said, yep. She goes, oh, honey, everybody around here has got a past. And I thought, I love this place. How could you not love this? I mean, for the first time in my life, I felt like I could be the train wreck that I was, and I wasn't going to be judged here. I am judged here, but I thought for a while there that I wasn't being judged here. So I'm in, you know, I'm in. And also I met a guy. I met a guy. And God's will, I suppose. And what the guy did was the guy helped me hit bottom. It's not the husband that I have here today. But this guy was going to help me really, really hit bottom. I'd been protected before that because it had somebody in my life that was cleaning up all the messes. But I got a new him now. So I'm going to let the old him go. He's in prison. Pfft, what? You know, so he gets out and is like, hey, sorry about your luck. And I'm off and running with this new guy that I met in AA, who was a chronic relapser, and he'd been in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out for 10 years. And a couple of guys in the meeting made the mistake of warning me about him, which if you're an alcoholic woman and they say, oh, stay away from him, it's like, gotta have him. Gotta have him now. Tell me what to do. So he and I tried to kill each other for the next couple of years. I mean, we were just violent and insane. We probably both had borderline personality disorder, and we were just crazy, right? And violent and just loaded and then not. And it was just going to go like that for another couple of years. Just absolute madness, you know, freak show in AA. And what ended up happening with that was we would fight, and I would throw him out, and then I'd find out the hotel he was in, and I'd go get him, and I'd bring him back. And then we'd have a little honeymoon for a minute, and then we'd fight, and then I'd throw him out, and then I'd go find out which hotel he was in, and then I'd bring him back. I got some girls laughing. I know you've seen this before. Okay, so this one time, I couldn't find him. I couldn't find him. You know, I usually knew which hotel, and I couldn't find him. And I got so upset about this, and I got so distraught that I thought, you know what, I'm selling my car, I'm moving to Maui. I'm going to go live in a tent in Maui. Turned out my car wasn't worth what I owed on it, so plan B was I'm going to eat a couple bottles of sleeping pills. And it seemed like a really good idea at the time. I can remember when I decided to do this, it was kind of like, oh, okay. I mean, I even got a moment of peace when I decided to do this. I went, oh, okay, that's what I'll do. So I ate a couple bottles of Salmonex and a 12-pack of beer, and I laid down, and I tried to die, and I didn't. Roommate came home, called. Anyways, long story short, I ended up in the hospital, and they're pumping my stomach and doing all that stuff, and I somehow in this whole thing had agreed to go to what they call a crisis center. It's a loony bin. You can call it anything you want. It's a loony bin. And while I'm in there, he found out that I was in there, and he called me on the payphone and asked me if I wanted to get married. And I, quite frankly, didn't have anything else to do. I mean, I was supposed to be dead. And nobody else had any other suggestions, so I went, all right, okay. And as an afterthought, I said, what do you think about going back to AA and getting sober? And I didn't want to get sober because I needed to be sober. I wanted to be sober because he needed to be sober. So we're going to go be in AA now, and we're going to go be sober, and we're going to get married. And I wouldn't get a drink anymore. And I drank again. I drank one more time. I drank the day that I got out. I went into a blackout. I married Lumpy, and the next day I remember coming to hungover, and I wasn't going to drink. I wasn't going to drink, and then I was going to have a couple of drinks, and that's not what I had. I had a bunch of drinks, and nothing was better. And this was supposed to fix everything. The booze was supposed to fix things, and he was supposed to fix things, and it was all just wrong still. So we started going to meetings, and we went to meetings for a couple of weeks, and we're going to be sober together in AA, and that's going to make this thing work. I'm going to give this a real try. And about 3 weeks later, he drank again, which is my cue to drink again, because that's what we do. And I don't really know how to explain it. I guess this is my what happened is I didn't want to. I was just tired, you guys. I was just so sick and tired of this mess, right? I don't want to do this anymore. So instead of going with him, I went to the Alano Club. And I'd been going to the Alano Club for quite a while, a couple of years. Hadn't made any friends or real contacts in there. I'd had women that tried to reach out to me, but I wasn't having it. I don't like women, right? I like the men. Okay, but I'm not really that receptive to the women, but I'm kind of a little bit desperate, right? And I'm standing there in the Alano Club and my whole punk thing, and this woman comes walking over and she stands right in my line of vision. She goes, "Hey, my name's Joni," puts her hand out, and I just kind of, yeah, okay, right? And she's over here into my line of vision again. She says, "I said my name's Joni," right? This is the most aggressive woman I've ever met in my life. And thank God, because she was going to be my first friend in AA. And she wouldn't let it go. She told me later that the only reason why she talked to me is because I was so bizarre looking, no one was ever going to have anything to do with me. And she felt sorry for me. And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, I thought you were a hillbilly, so there. But Joni and I were thick as thieves for years, and you know what? I will be real honest with you. I think the only reason why I actually got into the steps was to do them faster than Joni did. And the truth of the matter is I didn't really do anything for the first year that I was sober. I did get a sponsor, or I actually asked somebody to sponsor me. I wasn't really using her for anything. We weren't taking the steps or anything. Apparently, I needed some pre-step work, right? Skippy had this idea, right? I mean, I would call her with these problems and stuff, and it was just this rant, just this crazy rant. I mean, this manic thing talking at her, and she would do things like, "I want you to go scrub your toilet," or "I want you to go clean out your glove box," or "I want you to go clean out your closet." You know, and she would just have me do these chores and stuff like that, and which didn't make any sense, but they got me, you know, settled down for a couple of minutes. And I remember calling her up one time with the you know, big problem, whatever it was, this day, and I'm talking to her, I'm on the phone, and I'm telling her about, "Hey, and all the money's gone, and then I found this girl's phone number in his pocket, and then there's this weird thing on the door, and I'm talking away like this," and I talk really fast anyways, but I'm just, and right in the middle of my story, she says, "Did you make your bed today?" I'm like, "No, why would I do that, right?" She says, "I want you to make your bed, call me back." Click, hung up on me. Which is not a good thing to do, because, I mean, I'm crazy and I'm dangerous, right? She doesn't have any idea how dangerous I am. You know, "Do you know what I could do to you?" I mean, if she wasn't 80 years old, I swear to God. So I stomped around the house just angry. I was so mad, and I'm probably about 6 months sober. I'm just crazy, right? No steps, just no alcohol, no steps, out of my mind. I'm stomping around, I'm throwing things, I'm going to tell me, blah, blah, blah. And I call her back about, I thought 10 minutes to make a bed, no, better make it 11. So I call her back 11 minutes later, she says, did you make your bed? And I said, "Yes, I did." She says, "You're a flaming liar." Click, hung up on me. Right? So this is not getting better, you guys. So I made the bed. And it actually takes 2.5, maybe 3 minutes, but who knew? You know? So I figure that's how she busted me. I call her back, and she says, did you make your bed? And I said, "Yes, I did." And she said, "Did you really make your bed?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And she says, "Okay." And then there's just, like, silence. And I go, "Yeah, you going to tell me what that's about?" And she goes, "Yeah." She says, "You got a lot of problems." I said, "Yeah, I have a lot of problems." She goes, "They're very, very complicated problems." And I said, "Yeah, I'm trying to tell you they're very, very complicated problems." She goes, "You're a train wreck." I go, "I know. I'm trying to tell you about this." She says, "How are you ever going to straighten any of that stuff out when you can't even make your bed?" So I like to say that Skippy was kind of my Mr. Miyagi sponsor, wax on, wax off. Because just after a year sober, she turned me over to a lady named Michaeline, who was actually going to take me through the steps. And, you know, the stuff that Skippy would have me do, you know, cleaning out glove boxes and cleaning out closets and stuff, it was actually going to be a really good analogy for taking the steps for me. Because I'm a word picture person, and if you try and explain things to me, I don't get it. Right? But Michaeline could say things like, when you clean your closet, you're going to take everything out, and you're going to start sorting things out, and you're going to keep the stuff that's worth keeping, and you're going to get rid of the things. There's no other sock there. You know what I mean? And she's like, "That's kind of what the fourth and fifth step is going to be like." I'm like, "Oh, okay." I did kind of start the steps on accident. I don't think I really meant to. Michaeline was great at first. And then I would call her, and she would read this or, you know, do that, and always had, you know, great advice and this and that. And then once time she says, "Oh, that's a bad one. You better come over." So I show up over at her house, and the next thing I know, she's got me down on the couch, and we're she's got the book open, and she's got her arm around my waist, which was kind of creepy. And she has me, "Let's read this." And so we read this thing out loud, and she tells me, "You just did your third step. Now I want you to go home and start writing on your fourth." And she kind of gave me a little outline, and then she said, "I'm going to give you 2 weeks to get it done," which I thought it was ridiculous. It's like, 2 weeks to get my four-step done? She goes, "No, it's going to be like 14 months and 2 weeks. You've been screwing around with this thing long enough." And she wouldn't, that was it. So I show up over at her house, and I wasn't going to tell her everything, and I ended up telling her everything. I ended up telling her everything, and I wasn't going to tell her everything. I had two things on that list that I'd written down in code just in case I died on the way over there. No one would know what it was. And I'm not going to tell her, but I wrote it down just so I could, you know, do what I was told or whatever. And we prayed together, and she said, "Is there anything you want to tell me or anything you want to ask me?" And bleh, I just blurted those two things out that I wasn't going to tell her right off the bat. You know what she said? "Yeah, me too." She's this little soccer mom from La Mesa. I just told her the most scandalous thing that any human being has ever done in their life, and I'm thinking I'm going to prison, and she says, "Yeah, me too." And what we did for the next couple of hours is quid pro quo. I gave her some of my dirty stuff, and she gave me some of hers back. She matched me, right? She did not leave me hanging out there by myself. As I told her my truth, she shared hers with me. And at the end of the day, what she did was she put her arms around me, and she hugged me, and she told me that she loved me. And she told me I'd done a good job. And I don't know if anybody had ever in my whole life told me I'd done a good job, especially not about something academic, right? And that was my experience, you know, with the fourth and fifth step. A lot of people get this really spiritual connection and stuff. I didn't get that. It was kind of like the first time I ever had sex. It was painful. It was embarrassing. It was not what I expected, and I was just really glad to have it out of the way, basically. And the next time I go to a meeting, however, I come walking into the Olano Club the next day, and I had done the, you know, take the book down off the shelf and all this stuff, and I come walking into my next meeting, and it was different. I was a part of AA. I was in AA. I'd been around AA, and now I was in AA. I'm a step-taken member of Alcoholics Anonymous all of a sudden, and I could tell the other step-taken people of Alcoholics Anonymous from the not step-taken people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean, I was a part of something, like really a part of something. And, you know, and off we go. And the steps for me have been magical. Really. If you're newer in the program and you're a little intimidated by the steps, there's 12 of them and they happen in order. The first step makes it possible for the second step to become a reality. And the second step is going to make it a good idea for the third step. And the third step is going to get you ready for the fourth step. And then the fourth step is what you take to the fifth step. And then you share that with somebody and now you're going to take it on over here to 6 and 7, which is going to get you ready for 8. By the time you get to 9, there's a process that's happened for you that's going to make it okay. It's not like this is all just dumped on you at one time. It's magical. The way that this is broken down is absolutely perfect. By the time I got to every single one of the steps that I was doing, I really wasn't scared anymore. But when I'm standing here on 1 looking at 9, I'm terrified. But when I've been on 8 for a while, I'm looking at 9 and I just want to get going on it. And that's what the steps do. I was able to clean up almost everything that I'd broken. And again, when I say the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are magical, I mean, I was never going to be able to make this stuff right. And to the best of my ability, I made it all right. I ended up being able to care for my parents the last couple of years that they were alive, and it was such a gift and such an honor. I ended up getting to be a wonderful daughter. It just worked out this way, you guys, that I was able to stop by and see my mom in the memory care place every single day on my way to work. It just worked out that way. And all I'd have to do is go in for 10 or 15 minutes. And she would say to me all the time, almost every day, I'm really proud of you. And thank God I got you. She would say that. Thank God I got you. And she wasn't saying that in 1975, you guys. That was a holy terror. And she meant it. And I was able to make that right with them and heal all of that stuff. I was able to pay back every dime I owed. I was able to get myself straightened out legally. I was able to get a driver's license and my own Social Security card and a job and keep a job. And my life has just worked out better than I ever would have thought it was possible for my life to work out because of who I am. And I actually just did some 10th step work with her this morning, you know, that annual house cleaning that we do. And I'm so glad. I still have the same sponsor 29 years later. And she knows everything. She knows everything. I try and get away with stuff. She'll go, you shared that with me in 1993. And I'm like, what? How do you remember this stuff? But I have her, thank God, and one of the things that she's able to do, and she had to do it again today, I needed her to do this again today, is she needed to tell me how far I've come, because I can't tell. I still see everything that's wrong. I still see my shortcomings. I still see, like I was talking to Danny about before, it's like, I'm not as good as I wanted to be yet. You know? When am I ever going to get there? And I keep getting told, you don't ever get there, right? But she has to remind me that from where you came from to where you are now, you're not even the same woman. You're not even the same woman. So that's kind of my testimony, is that, you know, I used to hear a lot, you can't get here from there. I haven't heard that in a long time, but we used to say that when I was new. You can't get here from there, not from where I came from. And I've been able to be a good employee. I mean, I'm able to keep a job for 10 years at a time. I'm able to sponsor people. I'm able to be reliable. I'm able to do stuff that the girl that I was never going to be able to do. And I'm somebody who continues to take the steps. I found it necessary to continue to take the steps because I don't ever want to get drunk again. And I still have alcoholism. In fact, I'm a believer that my alcoholism is worse now than it was when I first got sober. This is a progressive disease, and I need it more now than I did 30 years ago. And I believe that. So I try and stay really in, and I try and stay really connected, not because I'm spiritual or anything like that, but because I need this. So I'm so glad that you guys are here. I'm so glad that Alcoholics Anonymous has stayed intact and that it still works. And I hope it keeps working for another century. So thanks for listening to me.